So when I was 7 years old, I was a student at R.E. Simpson Elementary School in Phoenix, Arizona. It's a brand new elementary school. It was that time in our national history when the baby boomer generation were all in elementary school, and they had to build a lot of schools to accommodate us. This was a new school. We had a second grade with 120 children in it, four classrooms, 30 kids in each class. And they had built a playground next to the classrooms, but because it was a new school, they hadn't put many things in it yet. There were a few slides and swing sets and one jungle gym, but not much really to play on. And the first day of class, the teacher said, "We want you to have a recess at 10:30. We'll ring a bell and you all go outside and you play in the playground. But we haven't had the money yet in the school budget to put a fence around the school. And there's a field right next to the playground that is private property. And you are not allowed to go into that field. You must stay on the playground." I mean, she said something like that. That's probably not her exact words anymore. It was a long time ago. So we went out to play, and after recess, I talked to a friend of mine, a new friend, and he said, "You know, I went over to the field, and it's great. There's all these weeds, and you can make paths in the place, and there's nothing to do. You know, there's no room for anybody in the swings because it's so crowded, and there's nothing really to do in the school playground, but the field is really great." So the next day, I joined him. And when you've got 120 kids to watch, it's not hard for two kids to just kind of head off into the field, and nobody saw us. And it was exciting, it was interesting. There were tumbleweeds in the field. And tumbleweeds are painful if you actually touch them. They have stickers on them, you don't want that. But they're fun to move around and just kind of imagine you're out in the wild west of Arizona and who knows who's going to be coming along, John Wayne on a horse or something. And it's just exciting. You know, maybe Clint Eastwood, although I think he was too young then. It was fun. We had a great time. We got back to class, the bell rang. Nobody noticed we'd gone into the field. And afterwards at lunch and on the way home, we mentioned it to some other boys. What a great time we'd had, how the field was exciting and interesting. So the next day, at recess, it wasn't just one kid or two kids. It was like seven or eight or nine kids. I don't know how many. But we all headed out and we got into the field. And we were standing around, I remember, talking about what we were going to do and how great it was to be in the field when we heard this voice, "You boys, get back over here immediately. You, come on." Well, when you're 7 years old, the immediate impulse when you hear that authoritative voice is to hide in the tumbleweeds. I thought it through very quickly, and I thought to myself, they're not going to give up on this. If we hide, they'll come after us, and they'll be even more angry. So instead of hiding with my friends, I walked to where the teacher was, and I stood next to her, and I turned around and I looked back. And I had this image that has stayed with me all these years. My friends were all crouched down in the weeds, and although they were trying to hide and not be seen, the weeds were thin enough that you could see the outlines of their bodies, every single one of them. And what I learned in my moral development that day was that often when you think no one can see you doing something you're not supposed to do, in fact, everyone can see you. Everyone can see you. So they sheepishly got up too and came and stood by the teacher, and then she chewed us out and told us how awful we were and how bad we were and how we were all in trouble and that she knew all of us and that if we ever did this again, we were going to get very terrible, horrible punishment of some kind. And then the bell rang and we went back to class. So I learned an important lesson in moral development that day that has stayed with me my entire life, that it's better not to hide in the tumbleweeds because they can see you. Better to fess up, especially if you're doing something you shouldn't be doing and you get caught. But my moral development was not completely over by the time I was 7. I still had some things I needed to learn. 10 years later, I was in high school, and then I graduated early and from high school, and I went to Phoenix Junior College to take classes there. And I went to a party in Scottsdale. Now, Phoenix and Scottsdale, if you know that area, they're quite a ways away, and depending on traffic, it can take you half an hour or an hour to drive from one place to another, quite a bit of distance. So here I was in Scottsdale, invited to a party, and there were mostly people I didn't know, and there was a young lady at the party that I, for some reason, really found attractive, and we started a conversation. Now, I thought of myself as a pretty dull and boring 17-year-old, that my life wasn't exciting and interesting, and if people really knew enough about me, they would think, oh, I have no interest in him. I wouldn't want to be his friend or spend time with him or certainly not go on a date with him because he has done nothing exciting or interesting in his life. And feeling that way about myself, feeling this low sense of self-esteem, and feeling that I was really not worthy of the people I was with, I decided to enhance my life as I talked to this young lady. Enhance is a polite word for lying about my life. I said, yeah, last summer I was in California, it's summer of 67, and I hitchhiked, the summer of love, I hitchhiked to San Francisco, and I went to Haight-Ashbury and got to know people there and crashed in various people's pads and on and on. I'd never been to San Francisco in my life. All made up, all to make me more interesting, to get the sense that I was an exciting and interesting person that someone would be interested in knowing. And this was a person who lived quite a ways away from me, I'd never met before and probably would never see again, so I would never get caught with this. And then I said, she said, well, where do you go to school now? I'm at Phoenix Junior College, that was true. Well, what are you studying there? Oh, I'm actually at the radio station on campus, the student radio station. I have an internship there and I do some on-air stuff. I had no idea where the radio station on campus was. Had no involvement in it at all. But I thought that would make me a lot more interesting. And indeed, at the end of the evening, she gave me her name and phone number. And I called her, and about a week later, we went out together. But by then, I'd had time to think about what I had done. And I started to feel incredibly awkward and embarrassed and ashamed. And after that one day, we did not go out again. I didn't call her anymore. And I thought, I didn't say to her, oh, by the way, I lied, because I just couldn't bring myself to do that. But I thought, if I never see her again, it won't matter. I just said to myself, I should never, ever do this again, because I might tell someone a lie, and then we might develop a relationship, a friendship, a connection, and then eventually they'll find out that I lied to them, that I told all these tall tales. So I should just always strive for candor and honesty. Well, then I transferred to Arizona State University, and I was walking along the campus mall, and there she was. She was also going to Arizona State. And I thought, oh, my goodness, how can I pretend that I didn't see her or something? But she came up, and we talked for a while. She was friendly, and I never said anything about the lies I had told. I never asked her out again. And I ran into her periodically, every few weeks or months, for 4 years. And every time I was reminded of how stupid I had been at that party in Scottsdale. You know, we are good enough the way we are. Who we are is not boring. None of you are boring. All of you are great and interesting just the way you are. You don't have to exaggerate. And it took me a long time in my teenage years to learn that about myself, that who I was good enough. And I vowed never to lie again. But of course, we don't want to get into too many absolutes here. We live in a democracy. I know some of you have some problems with our government in Florida and other places, but we are in a very open democracy where we are pretty much free just to be ourselves and to be open and honest. But sometimes people live in government situations where that's not the case. I was dating, and telling the truth, I was dating my wife, Leslie Westbrook. We were to get married later in 1980. And she told me a little bit about her family background. She had a sister who was married to a man who worked for the State Department. And he served in embassies around the world, and her sister would have the good fortune often to live in the countries where he was serving in the embassy. But right at that point, he was serving in Iran in 1980 in the embassy at the capital of Iran. And so they didn't think it was safe enough for families to be there. So her sister was living actually at that point in Athens, which is as close as they allow families to live for embassy people who were in Iran. And he would fly to Athens and they'd get together periodically. And then in November, I turned on the radio one evening and I heard a news report that the students had taken over the embassy in Iran. And in the days that followed, I watched the news, as did my wife, Leslie, to see if we could see a picture of this man. His name was Bob Anders. To see if we could see his name or he appear on lists or something like that. And they published, actually, in Time and in Newsweek, photographs of all the hostages, and Bob didn't appear. So my wife called her sister in Athens, and all she said was, "I can't talk on the phone about this." And that was the end of the conversation. So we didn't know what was going on. And then in January, we heard the news that six people had escaped from Iran with Canadian passports. And quickly, the news gave the names of the people, and Bob's name was on the list. They made a movie about this called Argo. But the people who really should get credit for this are not the folks in Hollywood, but the people in Canada, the whole country of Canada. The Canadian Parliament, Bob had a friend who he had played tennis with who was in the Canadian embassy. And they were able to escape, and they hung out in various apartments for about 6 days. But they figured that eventually they would get caught if they were in their apartments. Like they stayed in Bob's apartment for a while. So they called Bob called his friend in the Canadian embassy. And he said, "Come over." These people don't know whether they're risking their lives when they do this. But he said, "Come over." They lied. The President, Carter, the State Department, they didn't tell us what was going on. They kept this a secret. Some journalists found out about this, that there were Americans hiding in the Canadian residence, and a couple Canadian residents, and they agreed not to publish their stories. They hid this. They hid. And they lied. And then the Canadian Parliament, this should be a movie in itself. The Canadian Parliament had a secret session in which they voted to give passports to these six Americans. And that's how they got the passports that they were able to get out of the country in. So sometimes it's okay to lie. And moral theologians have a term for this. They call it the principle of overriding right. They say that sometimes, in order to protect life, rather than be a moral absolutist and say all lying is wrong, that there is a principle of overriding right that recognizes that sometimes a more important principle than truth-telling is at stake, such as the need to protect human life. When I visit Transylvania and I talk to folks who were alive during the Ceausescu period of communist occupation of Romania, they say, you know, the idea about honesty in America is naive because we had to teach our children from as soon as they learned to talk that they had to lie to government officials. They had to lie to the secret police. From the very beginning, in order to protect our families, our children learn to lie to the government to survive. So I learned that in our situation, with a government that doesn't really look upon us as threats, we think of honesty in all situations as good, but that is not always the case. There is this principle of overriding right. Now, finally, there's yet another kind of lie that we talk about. Does this suit make me look fat? The white lie. Most of us agree that some white lies may be acceptable in preserving harmony between people. Now, how often in your normal life do you tell white lies? There was actually a study done about this at the University of Virginia. It involved 140 students who were asked to keep diaries and record in that diary whenever they told a white lie, whenever they said, no, that suit doesn't make you fat, and make a record of that. And they found, after several weeks of keeping their diaries, and they were turned into the professor and they studied them, that these 140 people, young people, on average told two white lies a day. So that actually, I think that's fairly conservative. They may not have recorded everything in the diary. But the purpose of the white lies was to spare embarrassment, to maintain harmony among friends and family. And it is widely believed that those kinds of lies are appropriate in our lives in order to maintain civility and love between each of us, that sometimes we temper our frankness and our honesty with love and are careful about what we say in these white lies. There's even a Jewish passage in the Hebrew Testament where Abraham says some derogatory things about Sarah to God, and then when God talks to Sarah, he doesn't repeat those. So there is even theological justification for white lies. Of course, when it comes to serious lying, most of us are not confronted with a hostage situation. Most of us do not feel our government is a totalitarian dictatorship that we have to lie about. So living in Sarasota today, situations where lying is justified, I think, are rare. As a 7-year-old kid, I thought I was special. I thought the rules that the other kids had followed didn't apply to me. So I left the school grounds and explored the field. And when we got caught, I walked back to that playground and I looked back and I saw my friends hiding in the tumbleweeds and I could see them through the branches. The image has stayed with me Often when we try to deceive others, they can see easily through our deceptions. By the time I became a teenager, to impress a girl I was attracted to, I made up stories about myself. Afterward, I felt shame and embarrassment, the fear of being found out. This memory of this experience has stayed with me. I recall it each time I am tempted to exaggerate my accomplishments. So whether you are a car salesman, a politician, a religious leader, or a TV news anchor, unless you are living in a totalitarian state, it is best to aim for candor. Honesty starts with being ourselves and feeling that who we are, is good enough. This is good for our spiritual health, our emotional health, and the health of our religious community.